Well, over the years, there's been repeated attempts to predict a date when Jesus will return. There was one group, an example based in Sydney, called Mission to the Coming Days. And it was a few years ago, they predicted that Jesus was going to come back on the 19th of October at 2 a.m. Surprisingly enough, he didn't. We're still here. But the Sydney Morning Herald reported this. About 300 people gathered in Victoria Road on Wednesday night. A cheer went up at 2 a.m. When 2 a.m. arrived, the rain poured down and nothing else happened. 55 sheepish devotees of the Mission to the Coming Days emerged from the church's office between 2:30 a.m. and 5 a.m., faced by a crowd of hecklers. Apparently, there was a comedian who had been part of that crowd who was interviewed on television that night, and he said this: the people were so upset, you know they were all crying. This one guy was just crying his eyes out, and I thought, I've got to try and cheer him up a bit. So I went over, put my arm around him and said, mate, cheer up, it's not the end of the world. It's easy for us to laugh, isn't it, at people making such predictions. And I guess there isn't so many cast iron predictions out there now, but you will find people opening up their newspapers and looking at events in the world and saying, any time now. Well, we're starting a new series today and over the coming 5 weeks where we're going to have a look at what Jesus has to say about his return. From Matthew 24 and 25. And I guess over these weeks, we don't want to fall into the same trap as the Mission to the Coming Days. We don't want to fall into the trap of predicting when Jesus will return. But there's a sense in which we do want to be like that group, the Mission to the Coming Days. We want to have their confident expectation that Jesus is coming back. They had a great desire for Jesus to return. And I wonder, is that you? You know, do you have a confident expectation that Jesus is going to come? Now, I guess there'll be some of us in this room who will be maybe more slightly obsessive over dates. When every new incident in the Middle East comes, we think it is of great significance. But I think for most of us in this room, we think Jesus is coming back, but it has no real significance to our day-to-day life. We don't think about it. It doesn't really come across our mind. Well, our prayer is over the next 6 weeks, as we dig into what he teaches, we will gain an eternal perspective. We'll long for the day. Now, I'm aware, of course, there'll be people here this morning who wouldn't call themselves Christians, and you may be here sitting here thinking, this sounds all a little bit eccentric. Jesus coming back and the end of the world. Well, we're currently kind of interested in the end of the world, aren't we? We're listening to Greta Thunberg. She's talking a lot about the end of humanity, extinction rebellion, and all of that. And what I want to encourage us to do is say, well, maybe you are cynical, but why not listen to the most significant person there has ever been who divided human history in two and hear what he has to say about the future? Well, let's turn back in our Bibles to Matthew chapter 24. Have a look at page 993 in your church Bibles. And the issues we are thinking about are all provoked by some comments made by the disciples. Have a look at verse 1 of chapter 24 on page 993. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Now, these buildings would have included the temple in Jerusalem. It was one of the greatest architectural masterpieces of antiquity. It was made of marble. It was faced with gold. It was a glorious building, a breathtaking feat of engineering. And verse 2, do you see these things, Jesus said? Do you see these things? You know, the gold plated on the marble wall, this architecturally significant building. Truly, I tell you, not one stone will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. He tells them all, it's going to be destroyed. And they move out the city and they walk up to the Mount of Olives, which is opposite Jerusalem, and they're looking over the city. And the disciples pluck up the courage to ask the question. Have a look at verse 3. As Jesus was sitting down on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this thing happen? When will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? You see, there's two questions here. When will this happen? I.e., when will the temple be destroyed, Jerusalem be destroyed? And secondly, when will you come? When is the coming of the end of the age? And Jesus, in his answer from verse 4 through to verse 35, he gives them two horizons. Two horizons. One horizon is the destruction of the temple, the end of the Jewish age, as it were, not the end of the Jewish people, but the end of the way that they were going to worship, because the temple would be gone. And the second thing would be the destruction of the world. If you like, the end of the age of humanity as we know it. Just have a look down at verses 32 to 34, because I think they very helpfully shape the way we approach the previous verses. Just have a look at 32. You see, Jesus here tells a parable. And look at 32, what he says. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs become tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. He said, you know, we kind of know how seasons come about. We know what to look out for. You guys, the disciples, would have looked at the fig tree and you would have felt the sort of softness of the leaves, and you would have seen maybe the fruit starting to grow, and you'd have thought, ah, summer is coming near. I guess here in Norwich, what do we look out for to see the spring is on its way? Well, it's the growth of the beautiful daffodils. When the daffodils come out, we know spring is on the way. We get the principle, don't we? Fig tree, summer, daffodil, spring. And verse 33, he says, when you see all these things, you know that it is near. Now, what are all these things? Have a look back at verse 2. Have a look back at verse 2. What does Jesus say there? Do you see all these things? He is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. And so when you go back to verse 33 there, he says, even so, when you see all these things, the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, you will know that it, the final day, is near. Just like the fig trees, just like the daffodils, the sacking of Jerusalem is a sign of the next big event in God's diary. And what I want to do is persuade you that that is how the passage splits up and what it's pointing forward to. So in verses 4 to 28, it is about the events leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, the end of the Jewish age. And then verses 29 to 31, it is the return of Christ and the end of the human age. So firstly, the end of the temple. The end of the temple. You see, in between the days, between Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension, and the events of the conquest of Jerusalem, it's going to be awful for the disciples. It's going to be really unsettling. They're going to feel like the end of the world is nigh. Now just imagine it. Okay, in Matthew 28, Jesus tells them that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him. He tells them that he is king over absolutely everything. He has beaten death. And they start following him. And there's going to be a lot of things that make them think, really? Is that really true? Is what Jesus said is really true? And so have a look at verse 6b. Have a look at the second half of 6b. He says to them, such things must happen, but the end is still to come. He says, look, these things are going to happen. Have a look at verse 25. Jesus says, see, I have told you in advance. You see, he's warning them about lots of events and lots of ways things are going to happen, so they will not be unsettled when they do. And there's a number of different things that will happen. There will be frauds. Verse 5. Have a look. For many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah. Have a look at verse 23. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it, for false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. There'll be plenty of people claiming to be Jesus, claiming to be the risen, exalted Christ, saying, come follow me. Now, the disciples who are there with Jesus, I guess they could have thought, well, we're not going to be deceived by that because we know what Jesus looks like. But the disorientating thing for them will be verse 24, these messiahs, these false prophets will have power. Did you see that in verse 24? They will perform great signs. They will perform wonders. So often, I don't know, if you look at wider Christendom, they look for people with power, who have spiritual power, can do spiritually wonderful things. And Jesus here warns people, just because there's some form of spiritual power or supernatural ability doesn't mean it's divine. See, the goal of this is deception, to deceive people. And the distressing thing is, verse 5, many will come and many will be deceived. So verse 4, Jesus says to them, watch out that no one deceives you. Now, just so we know, I mean, how are you going to know when Jesus comes back? Jesus wants to be absolutely clear with us so we know that we don't accidentally miss his return because we're in the shower or something. There is a test in verse 27. Here is the test. Has Jesus come back? Has it been a worldwide global event that everyone sees and knows about? Have a look at verse 27. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so that it will be with the coming of the Son of Man. It will not be in secret. So when the Jehovah's Witnesses say that in 1914 Jesus came back, but it was in secret, he's invisible, you can't see it, the return, it's a lie. There's a guy in Australia right now who's making a lot of money doing seminars because he claimed after his divorce he realized he was Jesus Christ, and people pay lots of money to hear his seminars. Rubbish. Rubbish. See, there will be frauds. There will also be fear, verse 7, on a global scale. Nations will rise against nations, kingdoms against kingdoms. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. There will be such big events going on in the world that you'll think, how can the world carry on like this? And what does he want to know? That is not the end. The end is still to come. And there'll be people who will forsake Jesus, verses 10 to 12. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people, because the increase of wickedness, the love of most, will grow cold. It will be a brutal time. Because the people that you are praying with, will next day turn around and betray you for knowing Jesus. The work colleagues who are Christians, who you love so dearly, well, just the hassle of following Christ and the grief that it brings will draw them just to growing cold. But what they need to know is that will happen, but it's not the end. The end is still to come. See, how are they to respond to fraud and fear and forsaking? Verse 13. What are they to do? In fact, verse 13. The one who stands firm to the end will be saved. He says, stand firm. Don't be shaken by it. Don't be thrown by it. Forewarned is forearmed. And keep spreading the gospel, verse 14. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached, and the whole world is a testimony to all the nations. And then what? Look at the end of verse 14. And then the end will come. Now the question is here, the end of what? The end of what? You see, remember, he is talking to his disciples who have asked him the question, when is the temple in Jerusalem going to be destroyed? And then, when are you going to return? And in this first half, I think he is still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. He is saying to them, before AD 70, people will betray you. False messiahs will come. There'll be wars and rumors of wars. And actually, as you read the New Testament and you look back at the history, that is true. 2 Peter, Hebrews, people forsaking their faith because of persecution. You read Acts. What happens in Jerusalem in Acts? A massive famine. You read the history books. And Rome was constantly under threat. Israel was under threat. Kingdoms against kingdoms and nations against nations. But I know there'll be some people in this room who will look at verse 14 and say, but Andy, verse 14 hasn't happened, has it? By AD 70, look at it. The gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. You know, and there'll be some people here who will think, actually, the reason Jesus cannot come back today is because the gospel still needs to be preached and explained to every single tribe, tongue, and nation. And that will, once that happens, he will return. But actually, I think we have seen verse 14 fulfilled in the book of Acts. We're not going to turn to it, but there it is on the screen. Acts 1, verse 8. This is Jesus talking to his disciples, and he says, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. And if you read through the book of Acts, you see the gospel going in Jerusalem, and then it jumps over to all Judea, and then it jumps over to Samaria, and then by the end of the book, Paul's in Rome, the ends of the earth. And from there, the gospel will go to the ends of the earth. You see, in Acts, we see a fulfillment. It's not that the job is completely done, but there is fulfillment of verse 14. Paul's probably martyred around 62 to 64 AD. And here he says, verse 3 to 14, once these are the sort of events that have happened, but once verse 14 happens, then the end will come, the end of Jerusalem and the end of the temple. So, verse 15, this is what you are to do when you see a Roman army around Jerusalem. You see, he's saying them to stand firm, but secondly, he is telling them to flee Jerusalem in 15 to 28. Have a look at verse 15. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. See, Jesus here is teaching his disciples, stay in Jerusalem when your mates walk away from Jesus. Stay there when there's a famine. Stay when you hear wars or rumors of wars. But when you see the abomination that causes desolation, you flee. Now, the abomination that causes desolation is talked about by the prophet Daniel. We're not going to look back to there. But basically, it talks about something being in the temple that should not be there. That was partially fulfilled in 168 BC when a Macedonian king came and slaughtered lots of people in Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes, and he took a pig and he slaughtered it on the altar in the Holy of Holies. It was a devastating thing to happen for the Jews. But this is saying to the disciples, when you see an army coming and doing something similar, you have to flee. You have to get out of the city as fast as you can. Now just think about the significance for the church here. Jerusalem had probably one of the strongest churches in the world. It was a gospel hub. It was a gospel center that sent out missionaries all over the world. How devastating do you think it would have been for the gospel to have lost that church? Well, here is Jesus preparing them. And he says, against all your instincts, when you see an army approaching, where would you normally flee? You'd flee into the city. You'd flee into the city walls. That's the place of safety. He says, no, don't flee into the city walls. Verse 16, flee to the mountains. Verse 17, don't even go back into the house. Pick up your stuff. You won't have time. Verse 18, don't even get the coat. You don't have time. Verse 19, it is going to be awful for pregnant mums or nursing mums. It's going to be a horrific journey. Pray it's not winter. Pray it's not the Sabbath, but do something. Flee. Why? Verse 21. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. You see, when you look back at the history books, Eusebius, who's a historian, talks about just before AD 70, do you know what? Swaves of Christians left Jerusalem. And then Josephus, a Jewish historian, as the Roman army entered, he records this. They broke through the walls. They'd been camped out, sort of causing the city to be in famine and not have enough water. But as they eventually broke through the city walls, this is what they did. They made a frenzied attack on the temple. And he records this, most of the slain were peaceful citizens, weak or unarmed, and they were butchered where they were caught. The heap of corpses mounted higher and higher above the altar. A stream of blood flowed down the temple steps, and the bodies of those slain at the top slipped to the bottom. Heaps of bodies. Blood flowing down like a river. Terrifying. A great distress. He records, Josephus records, that 97,000 were captured, 1,000,000 were killed. It was Passover. Jerusalem was ram-filled. It was utterly devastating. See, here, Jesus is warning his people to be ready for that day, for the day in Jerusalem. It's a day they need to flee. But what about us? You know, here we are, AD 70 has happened. This has been fulfilled. What does it mean for us at this point, 2,000 years on? You know, is it that when we see an abomination that causes desolation in our own cathedral, we should leave? You know, that we see a helter-skelter. Maybe we need to flee because destruction's around the corner. No, it's not that. See, we need to learn the lesson of the fig tree. Remember that? the lesson of the daffodils. Verse 33, even so, when you see all these things, the things talked about in verses 15 to 25, when you see all these things, what are you to do? You to know that it is that it. Have a look at the little E. Can you see the little E? If you need your bifocals on, maybe. If you look at the bottom of the page, or he. Know that it or he is right at the door. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have happened. And as we look back, we can say, well, that generation hadn't passed away before all these things happened. But those things have been fulfilled. And so what is the next date in God's diary? What is the next event that is to come? What is the next big part of God's plan? It's Jesus' return. The end of the human age. He's at the door, and there is nothing left to happen to stop him coming in through that door. And so that's what we see in verses 29 to 31. 29 to 31, just have a look at them. Chapter 24. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then all the people of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. He says, look, that event will be unmistakable. It will be unmissable. Every single person on the planet will see it and will know it. I was Googling this week what has been the most watched event in history. And I think the website I found must be a little bit old. But it said, in 8th, the royal wedding was there, Wills and Kate. 400 million people watched that, apparently. The lunar spacewalk came in at around 4, with 530 million people watching it. Then the Chilean miners being rescued was number 2. 1 billion people watched that. And then the opening of the Beijing Olympics, apparently 2 billion people watched that. Well, Jesus here is talking about an event that 7.6 billion will see. And before they see it, they will hear it. As the trumpet sounds, it will be unmistakable. Everyone will be on their knees. And for some of us, it will be the greatest day of our lives as we see our personal saving King come to bring us home for eternity. But for others, it will be a day of mourning. In verse 30, he says that it will be a day of mourning and howling and weeping as they realize just how wrong they've got life. As they realize that they were wrong to ignore Jesus and his offer of forgiveness and salvation. I wonder, have you understood that Jesus is at the door? Now, I could appreciate some people might push back and say, well, Andy, but look at verse 29. It says, immediately after the distress of those days, immediately he would come. And here we are 2,000 years on, and where is he? And I think my answer to that is 2 Peter. What is written in 2 Peter, that with the Lord a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. And his patience is not in not coming is because he wants you to turn to him. You know, there's no reason in God's big plan, there's no other big events to happen that is stopping him from coming, but maybe he is held off his return because he wants to welcome you into his eternal kingdom, into him safely home. You know, maybe you know you are not right with Jesus today and you think, I need to talk to someone about it. Talk to someone who brought you. Come and have a chat with me. We'd love to talk to you more about that. But I guess for a host of us, for most of us here, we do believe Jesus is coming back. But actually, we don't think about it. You know, the next big event that we think in God's diary is, I don't know, sort out my house or help me have another kid or having a, that's not a prophecy when, from our point of view, or I'm going to move, or those sort of things. You know, I've got this deadline to do in my diary. But what we've got to understand, God's big plans, his next big plan is Jesus coming back. We're going to be thinking about what that looks like over the next 5 weeks as Jesus digs into the detail of how to live in the in-between times. And there's parable and parable and parable, and it's going to be dynamite. But why not this week? Why not this week? If you have a paper diary, if you have a digital diary, it's slightly more, less easy. But why not write at the top of each day, he's coming? Top of each day of your diary, he's at the door. So that when you start the day, you've got the perspective. When things are happening in the day, you've got that eternal perspective. I've bumped the car. What a headache! But he's coming. You know, I've got to do all this stuff for church. It's such a slog making things happen. No one sees it. But he's coming. He is, he's coming. Oh, there's this person at work. I know I should tell them I'm Christian, but I don't know how they'll respond. He's coming. Oh, I'm really struggling to make time today to pray for that friend to come and know Jesus. He's at the door. The daffodils are out. And it is worth saying, from verses 4 to 14, as we are reading that, the frauds, the fears, the forsaking, they sound like today, don't they? They sound like the world we live in, Iran, the bushfires in Australia, an earthquake in Puerto Rico, a plane being shot down. It sounds like verses 4 to 14, and we've got to know, Jesus says, this stuff won't stop after AD 70. In fact, this stuff will carry on going until he returns. And so we need to watch out that we are not deceived. We need to stand firm. We need to keep preaching about Jesus. Over Christmas, I watched a program that was a review of the year. Actually, it was a review of 2016. It's sad. I need to get out more. But on this program, there was this comedic presenter who was interviewing this chap, Dr. Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox. He's a popular scientist. You may also know him as a keyboard player of the 90s pop group D-Ream. And he was asked, how is the world going to end? How is the world going to end? And do you know what his answer to that was? He said, the sun's going to run out of fuel in 4 billion years or so, but before that, it will expand and the world will get incinerated. To which the interviewer said, you're much gloomier than I expected. And actually, you lied to us when you sung the song with D-Ream, things can only get better. See, everyone thinks the world's going to end. Everyone thinks that. The question is how. Let me just read to you something that was written 30 years ago by a brilliant theologian and evangelist, a chap called Michael Green, and he wrote this in his commentary. This is our hope. History is moving steadily towards that grand day. We shall not go out like a light. We shall not be blown sky high in a nuclear holocaust. We shall not destroy the earth by our environmental vandalism. 30 years ago, he wrote this. This world will not, however, go on forever. Jesus will come again. not this time to suffer, but to reign. Let's bow our heads. Father God, as we again hear your word and hear these truths and are confronted with realities that just don't seem to match our day-to-day, and yet they seem to match our day-to-day perfectly as we see the horrors that go on in our world and the uncertainties and the environmental vandalism and the threats of terror and all these other things. Father, thank you that there is a secure plan. Thank you that this world is safely in your hands and it is heading to a final glorious end point. Father, thank you for the hope that we can have as we look to the future. The next big date in the diary is Christ's return. Thank you that the daffodils are out, as it were. And Father, we pray that this week we might remember that. And that through these coming weeks, we consider these different parables. May we, as your church, be gripped by that day and live wholeheartedly in the light of it for Jesus' glory. In his name we pray. Amen.